I think Albert and I will arrange ourselves here so we can share the microphone, and perhaps we could have a line form over there, and you could come up here and pose your questions. And Albert, do you have anything to say before we get going? Do you want to limit the scope of discussion?
I do want to make clear what the purpose is of Friends of Science, because we are labeled an advocacy group. I think the main purpose is to convince people of what has been said, in fact, by co-workers in the IPCC, that the uncertainty of climate science is of such a magnitude that no government should have it in its mind to design programs of tens of billions of dollars. Secondly, talking about websites, Friends of Science has a website which is very easy to find. It's friendsofscience.org. One word, friendsofscience.org. And you will find a lot of the references, papers and articles and what have you. And in fact, you can download the video from it as well to get the background of some of the arguments that have been put forth by our academic speakers.
Okay, do we have any questions forthcoming? I'd like to remind you that when you come up, please state your name for the sake of the television audience, and let's carry on.
Hello, I'm Dr. Hester Jeskut. I'm a glaciologist at the university here in Lethbridge, and I know something about climate change. And I wanted to give a little bit of a balanced picture, because as you actually stated, this video is very much one-sided. So actually I want to answer some of your questions. You started with four questions, and the first one is, how is temperature measured? And in fact, the question is, how is climate measured? Climate change measured. Temperature, if you look at what IPCC, the policymaker, says, is that the average global temperature has increased 0.6 of a degree over the last 100 years. That is taking all the measurements of all our stations that we have all around the world. And it's true that a lot of those stations are in urbanized areas. And one of the arguments in the video is that urbanized areas have higher temperatures than areas around it. But the highest temperature change that has been measured over the last 100 years is in the Arctic. And there's no big cities in the Arctic. So that argument is a little bit skewed. So that's one of the things that I want to bring into...
I'm thinking that... generally, we pose questions to the
short
speaker, relatively short questions, and I'm thinking maybe we already have a candidate for making another presentation.
Okay.
We'll keep that in mind.
I wonder if I can address your questions one by one, because if you have a list there by the end of it, I'll have forgotten what you started with. First of all, about temperature measurement, could you show number three, please? Give you an idea of what we're talking about in terms of urban heat islands. This is not a measured record, but it is an idea of what we're talking about in terms of how the cement, the asphalt, the buildings, the activities of a city affect the measurement of temperatures. Now, I'd like to say that temperature measurements, in fact, have only been in effect since 1850. Before that time, thermometers and temperature observations were just haphazard and non-existent. The other one I want to show you, since we're talking about the Arctic, could you please run through numbers 10 to 15 for me? You should probably look at those two. These are records. This is Antarctica, temperature record. Yeah? Go ahead. Gotthard, Grundland. Where is the increase? Tell me, where's the increase? This is Iceland. These are all official government records.
Which government?
This is Vostok, Antarctica.
They're all in Dutch.
Better stay close to the microphone, Albert.
Well, there you have a cross-section. There's also a bunch of these all through the United States, from rural stations in the United States. And to show you the difference between urban records and rural records, maybe you can show... where are my Australian ones? I'm sorry, I can't find that. Okay, in any case, there are records from 12 Australian cities and 12 Australian rural areas. And in the Australian urban areas, the temperature graph goes like that, and in the rural areas, it stays rather level. So there is an enormous difference. The other thing is that I should point out that not all in urban areas, but the distribution, if you look at the distribution chart of temperature stations around the world, quite apart from the oceans and the deserts where there is virtually none except the old ship, it is very much slanted towards urban areas, particularly in America and Europe. That is why the statistics are really, really slanted. Now, there has been, as you say, 0.6 per 100 years that is established. We're coming out of the Little Ice Age, and that is the average increase that we have been having, and we're still having it. There are bumps along the way. In fact, there's one bump the other way, which is from 1940 to 1975, when temperatures dropped.
My name is Dr. Mark Sandilands. The doctorate is in psychology, however, not earth science. But in my academic career, I did learn that if you have a complex area, you look at the experts in the field and find out what they're saying. My question is, of the experts in climate science, what percent believe that carbon dioxide is a factor in global warming? And of those who are on that camp, and those who are in the group that are climate change deniers, what is the amount of funding that each group has received from the petroleum and coal industry, and which ones are independent sciences, and who will benefit if, in fact, we do nothing about the carbon dioxide production that our civilization is producing, and who will benefit if we do cut back on the amount of carbon dioxide that we produce?
All I can say is there's always one in the crowd who is doubting our credentials, our motives, and, sir, our ethics. And I take that personally. Calgary is a city which has the highest component of earth scientists and atmospheric scientists in the nation. It is no wonder that there are well over 2,000 geologists alone in the city who have, all through their work, worked with paleoclimatology. These people that are active in Friends of Science Society are all retired. There may be one or two who are still consulting, but they are basically in their 60s and 70s. I'm almost 80. I've worked for oil companies. Yes, I have. I have no loyalty to any oil company. I'm a scientist, and I have my own ethics, and I belong to associations that demand those ethics. So that's point number one. As far as funding is concerned, we are a membership society. We are a registered, profit society under the Alberta Societies Act, we have not accepted any gifts, any donor donations from people that are blatantly trying to get a corporate oil view on record. Our normal household expenses come out of membership dues and out of personal gifts and donations from people that think that we, as only group in the country, are doing a very worthwhile job. When we get to a $200,000-$300,000 effort like making this video, and you probably know video making is not cheap, we depend on charitable organizations who are, in fact, the University of Calgary has a charitable organization which has funded the investigation into the debate of climate science. And that is how we get our money. If you want to know who contributes to the foundation, you better ask the university. I don't know. Now, I also object to your calling us climate global warming deniers. We are not. It's been said in the film that we believe that the Earth is warming. We are also not denying that CO2 is not an effort. As a psychologist, I think you should investigate why you are saying these things. You have just been told that that is not what we are advocating. Any more questions?
Go on. Thank you. John Boris here. I think we should give both sides boxing gloves, because all respect to you, sir, and respect to the gentleman who was here, Mark, I think it is, just a few minutes ago, you both got degrees, and you claim your scientific knowledge is superb to his, I think, at least I noticed that. You know, I'm a lawyer, and I'm a Johnny-come-lately lawyer, and you know, if we had to have a fight in court, I would be in court, and I would work for somebody that paid me, very likely, though I could actually work without payment. There are lawyers who retire like myself that do that. But I would be using both of you, or both of your people to support. And I think, and I'd like you to answer this, do you not think that regardless of what you put up there, lots of people deny that that's so, and a lot of people say it is. And if an election comes along, there's going to be a question. Maybe it won't be straightforward, but we'll be there. Are you supporting Kyoto as it is? And I would just like to remind you that I understand that in the United Nations there's overwhelming support, and I may be wrong, for the Kyoto program to be supported. Comments, please.
The question, John, was?
The question was
support Kyoto.
Yeah, and how do I, as a lawyer or somebody that has got no degrees at all, but got a good education in life, and we got to decide, and it's a political question. How do I make that decision?
Well, the reason that we, unpaid, by the way, are making these tours and talking to people like yourself is because that is the only thing that we can do. We don't have $1.3 billion to throw at mesmerizing the nation. You know how Environment Canada, if you look at the public accounts, have been subsidizing anything from the Sierra Club to the Greenpeacers, Suzuki Foundation, the Pembina Institute, in Alberta even Climate Change Central, which is also in the business of sequestering CO2 and that sort of business. No, we can compete with that. The only thing that we can do is this. Now, you see on the other hand that the foundation is crumbling under Kyoto. There is, as I said in the beginning, there is the statement by Tony Blair, for instance, that he is no longer really supporting the implementation of Kyoto. And that was after the House of Lords has told him that. And after Yuri Israel, who is the vice chairman, by the way, of the IPCC, has in fact said that science underlying Kyoto is lacking, is a failure, and doesn't prove anything. Now, in a court of law, what I would like to see, it is not a practice which is usually indulged in science, is that people would put their points to a forum, to a knowledgeable forum, and get judged on the veracity of their science. Take a guy like Michael Mann. It has never happened to Michael Mann. Michael Mann's hockey stick paper was first published in an issue of Nature magazine, which is a peer-reviewed paper. I've got a son who is a professor in the East. He knows about peer review. You know how shoddy it often is done, and how little time the reviewers are given to make these reviews. Particularly, you get into a thing like what Mann has been doing, which involves an enormous amount of programming, computer programming, and data handling and statistics. And it takes a guy McIntyre, Stephen McIntyre, who is in fact a due diligence man for the mining industry, to come in here and say, hey, this data that has been manhandled, that doesn't fit. And the program is wrong. So the whole hockey stick disappears. That has never happened to Mann's paper. It went through the Nature peer review, it went through the IPCC, and it came into the SPM without anybody raising a stink. Now, how we fight that, I don't know. There's an organization, you fight government, okay? I don't know how to fight government. Sorry.
We have another question. Ken.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My name is Ken Eichel, and I'd like to ask you a question here. I've been listening to a lot of CO2 being expelling here. And I remember reading about Apollo 13 and the problem they had when their oxygen machine broke down and they had to do a fix on it. And they wouldn't have lived because they were breathing CO2 unless they could fix and get oxygen. So in this room here right now, how much CO2 do you think is being put out? And is there a measurement to measure CO2? Like, for example, 1880s, there were so many people in the world and they were breathing so much CO2. And this generation in the world, there's millions of people, and how much CO2 are they breathing out? And are they the actual cause of global warming? And the government says, yes, we are. And they're saying that CO2 is going to be classified as a toxin. So basically what you can't do is you can't breathe, you can't flatulate, you can't expand methane. So what they're going to do is they're going to shut all the people down. But the basic question is, can you measure at this time how much CO2 is being expelled by humans, what the effect is on... they see the government and all so-called enviros say that CO2 is the most catastrophic effect on global warming. Well, I think we better all shut up and not breathe again, and maybe we won't have a problem with CO2. But one other question, part of that question, the measurement, and also the fact that, again, the government is going to designate it as a toxin. You know, so again, how they're going to measure that. And are we going to get Kyoto emission credits when we all die, or so we don't breathe anymore?
Well, there's a thing known as the CO2 balance of the Earth. It's measured in gigatons of carbon, and the total amount of carbon on Earth in the atmosphere is 750 gigatons. And there is something like 40,000 gigatons in oceans. And there is a lesser amount, I forget exactly, I think 12,000 or so tons in the biota. And our contribution to the annual balance of carbon is 6 gigatons worldwide, in a reservoir of which totals about 900 gigatons. Half of that gets absorbed in the largest carbon sink that we have, which is the oceans. When the ocean's warm, by the way, that is one reason that CO2 comes out when temperature goes up. When ocean warms, solubility decreases, and the dissolved gases in the ocean come out and increases CO2. But that is the... Now, how they measure that, sir, I don't know. I'm not in that field.
I can add just a little bit to Ken's question about how much humans might contribute. I actually worked carbon dioxide exhalation for cattle out once upon a time, and it amounted to about the same amount as our cars exhale. So cattle aren't too different from humans, just a bit bigger.
Now, it has been measured that within the northern temperate zone, between 1981 and 1991, the increase in biomass was about 10%, which could probably be attributed to the tree line going farther north and farther up. Has that increase in biomass occurred, and do you think it's a good thing or not?
Oh, thank you. As Sally is saying in the video, the biomass has blossomed in face of the increases in CO2. Now, the increases in CO2 are a fact, because there's no denial. If you look at CO2 in a historic framework, it isn't really that high. It has been many times higher. It's been 20 times as high, in fact, as it is at the moment. Otherwise, I would say, well, you know, suppose that we are increasing global warming. I think in Canada, we can do with a bit of it.
Another question here, Albert. My name is Bob Babke, and I want to go just a bit of a different way, because I'm not a scientist, and I can't hope to compete with either side. I can read and make some decisions myself, but my concern is more on how it may affect us in other ways, and I look at it, and I agree that probably it is some sort of political decision that's been made, and although I don't... agree with a lot of politicians, I never take the view that they are absolute idiots. There must be some basis for the kind of political decision that the UN made in coming out with IPCC and going the route that they did, which appears to have been before a lot of the science was in effect. And I'm wondering if you have a view, sir, as to what that purpose might have been. What would that political purpose have been to go on this massive exchange of wealth that we're about to endeavor on, and why would that kind of decision be made if the science isn't so clear?
Very good question.
That is an excellent question, and since I don't really want to start talking politics here, it was one that I could have avoided. But so be it. You're right, and it is a very legitimate question. The history of the whole effort goes back, in fact, to the 70s, but it was really formalized in the United Nations framework in the early 80s, at which time some people, in fact, related to creating another monster now that the wall with the East was down. No, I find that one far-fetched, but you can see where people start looking for answers to this question. The ecology movements, the environmental movements, were looking for a cause. And there was a man by the name of Dr. James Hansen, who's a NASA scientist, who had the idea that we were increasing the greenhouse, and as we were increasing the greenhouse, of course, we were capturing all this CO2, and boy, you could see it. The temperature in the Earth was going up. And this was embraced by the environmental groups who got the United Nations to put, who have an environmental department, to put a program together, which reached its origin of the IPCC system at about 1988. It is interesting to look at the way in which at that time the United Nations changed the scientific definition of climate change. I cannot quote it verbatim, but the original definition of climate change has to do with changes in climate over periods of 30 years, period, by whatever cause. The United Nations changed that to changes in climate over a period of 30 years as caused by human activity. That got the working groups underway, and working group number one, which is the scientific group, immediately had the problem as to what sort of experts they were going to have to address this, because there were people that were saying, well, why only talk about human causes, anthropogenic global warming? I mean, there are natural causes, there are lots of natural causes, that's got to be part of it. It was suppressed. And when the first assessment report came out, and the second and the third, now, shortly, I think the first one was 96, the second in 99, and the third one was in 2001, there were voices within these reports that questioned the methodology and the exclusion. Now, AR4, the fourth assessment report of the United Nations IPCC, will be out in 2007. I've seen a draft of it. The draft has changed the definition of climate change back to what it was before. But the damage has been done. Now, James Hansen, the man who got the whole global warming on track with the United Nations, and whose paper of that day that supports what you were saying there, in, I think it is 2001, made a statement in a conference that, well, yeah, okay, yeah, CO2, but, you know, CO2 really wasn't the most important thing. We had to really look at other causes for warming, any change of climate as well. So, it is political. People that know the United Nations and how the United Nations work see dark motives, which are in terms of world government and finding an issue with which they can dominate world policy in certain aspects. I'm not passing any judgment on this. This is what I read. I stay out of that debate.
Well, I don't know whether the moderator can add to that or not, but he will anyway. If climate change really is a problem, it is a global problem, and I think that explains the United Nations' interest in it sufficiently, being about the only world governing body we have on hand. Another question, please?
One short question. If H2O, so if water vapor actually is the major greenhouse gas effect, do we actually produce more because we drive cars and we have industrial activity? And shouldn't we actually do something about that then?
The effect of H2O in the heat budget of the Earth is quite complicated. And the simplest thing I can say about it is that, okay, the heat comes from the sun, and there is some heat that comes from the internal engine of the Earth. If there was no H2O in the atmosphere, either water vapor or clouds, we would get an awful dose of heat, because the water vapor in particular dissipates and absorbs a lot of it. Now, in what Jan Weitzer is saying, he is the guy of the cosmic ray flux. The cosmic ray flux ionizes the water vapor in the atmosphere. By doing so, it creates condensation nuclei for water droplets and makes clouds. That is a very important aspect of water vapor. Now, what do the clouds do? Depending on the frequency of the radiation, short wave, long wave, it either reflects sun rays and heat back into the atmosphere, or it prevents expelled heat from the Earth to get out from underneath the greenhouse effect. That balance is so difficult to quantify that the computer programs have been totally unable to deal with water vapor. It is one of the biggest failures of the GCMs, the computer simulation programs of Environment Canada and the United Nations.